The Health and Human Service Policy Committee will now come to order. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Health and Human Service Policy Committee. We have an ambitious schedule of bills and topics to address this year. Many more will be added as we move through the session. I'd like to start by introducing several new members of our team. And as I mentioned your name, if you could just raise your hand. Anna Benelli with House Research, who will cover the Health Department, licensing, and tobacco issues. Is that correct, Anna? Welcome. Michael Meilenberg, Republican Caucus Research Staff. Elaine Fair of the Republican Caucus Constituent Services Staff. And our lead committee page, Dan Listig. Hey, Dan. As I mentioned, in the coming weeks, we'll be addressing issues that will touch all of us in many different ways. Hospitals, nursing homes, employers, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, lawyers, hospices, personal privacy, and many more topics. Today we'll start with one of the bills that we've been discussing for several weeks, and we will refer to it as the Healthcare Cost Containment Act. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bradley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. And let me say a huge appreciation to you particularly and to the members. We have spent a lot of hours already. I think we had almost a five-hour hearing on this. And even today's hearing is a little out of the ordinary because, frankly, it's a hearing to sort of finalize the debate before even I myself as the author then will put those debates to some kind of work to make some modifications, changes, additions to the bill. In other words, we will not actually be moving on the bill today. That will happen, I believe we're scheduled for Monday, February 16th is when we'll actually do that, members, and I just want to make that clear. Today's meeting is all about groups that sort of want to have their final chance to add to the discussion that we already had during the 5 hours of debate, and I hope that the testifiers will sort of keep that in mind, that, that although there may be some repetition, we're trying to sort of complete the rest of the debate. I am going to choose members not to sort of march through the bill. I mean, I will be certainly happy to answer any questions. We already have done that. The bill itself and the summary have been available to the members now for some numbers of weeks. What I would propose to do is that we go ahead and listen to this testimony from people who have something to add to our discussion and debate, and then hopefully we'll have time before the morning ends where we can come back and have some discussions, as I know there were members who had individual questions. And I certainly would defer to the chair. My suggestion would be that we minimize the debate along the way with the individual testifiers, unless there's clarification, and then try to save that when we have an opportunity for discussion. And then, members, and I may be, I don't know what the chair would also tell you, but you'll notice that we are going to recess until 12:15. You could essentially characterize the afternoon session to be the follow-up to what I think Representative Huntley suggested. Now, we didn't bring all the committees together, but we're going to allow for an extended period to discuss the medical malpractice issue. And there will be representatives to discuss that on both sides. And that's sort of the format of the day. As I said, the purpose of the day is to sort of refine our discussion debate in preparation for actual movement on the bill starting on February 16th. So with that, Madam Chair, unless there's any specific questions, I would stand aside and allow testimony to continue.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. I would like to move the minutes. Representative Tao, would you move the minutes of the April 16th meeting?
So move.
So move. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. We also have minutes from the January 15th meeting, and I'd like to have, Representative Wilkin, would you move those minutes? So move. All those in favor of adopting the minutes of the January 15th meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. As Representative Bradley said, we have kind of an ambitious schedule today. As you remember, the last time we touched on this bill, we heard it was about 5 hours of testimony. So if possible, members, if you need some things clarified, we can do that. But I guess we can have this go as long as you'd like it to be, but it would be helpful if we could hold the questions, at least for Representative Bradley, till the end. If we need to ask the witnesses specific questions to clarify, we certainly can do that, but let's be mindful of the time. With that, Julie Bruner, good morning.
Good morning.
And all of you are aware of that, but just please introduce yourselves for our tape and always mention who you are or who you represent.
Good
morning.
Welcome
to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council is the trade association for the nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning and to comment on House File 1681. And I want you to know that I got up a half hour early, went through my testimony, and really tried to get it down as short as I can because I realize you really have a busy agenda. There are many items in House File 1681 that we agree will help slow health care spending in Minnesota. I'd like to highlight a few of these and talk about some of the work that the health plans are currently doing in this area. As you know, spending on health care is rising due to new drugs, new treatments, and medical devices. As a society, we're using health care services due in part to our aging population and in part to a real increase in the demand for health care services. There's no doubt that these medical advances improve people's lives, and yet they also add costs. Slowing costs while improving care is the goal I think we all share. We're pleased that Representative Bradley's Bill 1681 recognizes and encourages the value of disease management and evidence-based medicine as ways to control costs and improve care. Minnesota's health plans are working in several areas that show great promise. In the area of disease management, health plans are working with employers to manage the health risks and medical conditions of employees and of their employees and families. Disease management programs use medical training and personalized services to improve patients' health. Program participants receive personalized expert advice and support to help them be healthy and manage their condition or disease. These efforts save health care and taxpayer dollars by reducing trips to the emergency room and avoiding long hospital stays. But most importantly, these types of programs give patients an opportunity to feel in charge and involved in their own health. Employers know that program results in improved productivity and a reduction in lost work time. A couple of examples. Over a 12-month period, one health plan disease management program helped improve the health of its enrollees with 17 chronic conditions and disease, while at the same time saving an estimated $36 million, or $41 per member per month. The plan estimated that for every dollar they invested in disease management, they got back $2.90 in the first 12 months. This combination of conditions affects between 10 and 15% of this health plan's population. Yet these enrollees typically account for 40 to 45% of the health plan's medical spending. So we can see that this is a wise use of targeting health care dollars. Another example, based on another health plan's data, roughly 35% of an employer's workers covered under the health plan drive nearly 90% of all claims costs. This health plan showed that disease management programs reduce annual claims expenses between 3 and 6%. While cost control is an important result, improving the quality of care is essential. And this is another element of Representative Bradley's bill, evidence-based medicine. Minnesotans deserve the very best care medical science has to offer. Evidence-based medicine means that physicians combine scientific research and the latest information available to them as physicians in order to provide patients with the best treatments. You may recall a hearing about 2 weeks ago, a joint hearing with the Commerce Committee, where Dr. John Frederick from Preferred One discussed a real innovative quality initiative that relies on best practice. These are the kinds of initiatives that we think hold great promise as well. Next, I'd like to address the provision in 1681 that would permit for-profit health plans in Minnesota. First, let me state that Minnesota's health plans welcome competition. They compete with each other all the time. We also believe that the nonprofit model has served Minnesota very well. Minnesota is consistently rated one of the healthiest, if not the healthiest state in the country. We have the lowest uninsured rates, and we believe that the nonprofit model has contributed to these rankings. The community's best interests are first and foremost in a nonprofit health plan mission. For-profit health plans, on the other hand, are committed to maximizing profits for stockholders. For-profit companies must generate profits to support the company's operating demands as well as provide competitive returns to stockholders. A nonprofit health plan's primary goal is to serve the community by conscientiously conducting its business to control medical and administrative expenses. Nonprofit health plans do not pay dividends to stockholders. They don't have stockholders. Instead, any financial gains are redistributed back into the community in the form of more and better health services, lower premiums, or both. In fact, studies show that without the demands of Wall Street, nonprofit health plans adopt business and pricing strategies that generate sufficient operating margins that they pay out a greater percentage of premiums in health care claims than for-profit plans. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, found that investor-owned health plans increased their profit margin from 1.8% in 1999 to 4.4% in 2002. The higher margins were achieved mainly by reducing the percentage of premium used to pay health care claims. Significantly more of the nonprofit health plan dollar goes toward customer health care services and less goes toward administrative expenses than for-profit health plans. For 2002, the average administrative cost for Minnesota health plans was about 8.3%. Administrative costs for health plans are considerably lower than those of most other health insurance companies in Minnesota. The average administrative costs for health plans other than HMOs in Minnesota, these are such as in the indemnity insurers, are much higher at 13.4%. A special article in the April 2002 New England Journal of Medicine compared for-profit and nonprofit health plans. In the article, researchers assessed the medical care of enrollees in for-profit and nonprofit HMOs. The results show that enrollees in nonprofit plans were more likely to be very satisfied with their overall care than enrollees in for-profit plans. Among enrollees in for-profit HMOs, sick enrollees were more likely than healthy enrollees to report unmet need or delayed care. Enrollees in for-profit plans also reported higher out-of-pocket spending during the previous year. The article concluded, for-profit HMOs are rated less favorably than nonprofit HMOs by patients in fair or poor health. Minnesota is known for its aggressive regulatory environment. As a condition of licensure in this state, health plans are required to participate in the state government's health care programs. That's not the case for HMOs elsewhere. Here, the health plans are held to stronger standards of financial strength than other places in the country. And here, the health plans are highly scripted in the types of copays, deductibles, covered benefits, and other products that they can offer. If the legislature were to decide the law to change the law to permit for-profit health plans, we believe the law must treat both nonprofit and for-profit health plans equally. If you're going to do this, We want a level playing field. Then you'll have competition. As we know,
I'm hearing from you wrap up. I'm sorry.
I will. I'm sorry. As we know from hearing Minnesota Department of Health presentations, more health plans won't mean lower premiums. Our neighbors in Wisconsin know this firsthand. The direct link to premium prices is not the number of HMOs in the state, but the spending on medical care. In summary, I just ask you to keep one thing in mind. Healthcare premiums equal the cost of medical care plus administrative costs divided by the number of enrollees. That's what sets healthcare costs. We very much appreciate the opportunity to present our position on this bill. We want to commend Representative Bradley for his open process, his willingness to talk to us as he put the proposal together, and we look forward to working with you as this bill makes its way through the process. Thank you very much.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much. Next testifier scheduled is Bob Johnson. Good morning. Welcome
Good morning,
to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And briefly, I want to strongly support House File 1681 and the reforms contained herein and urge the committee to support and pass this. There are a wide range of issues in the current crisis in the healthcare marketplace that House File 1681 addresses.
At this point, I believe we will hear testimony from Joel Carlson. Joel, you ready? Okay, we will hear testimony from Joel Carlson and those witnesses that he has with him. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in Minneapolis, and I'm here on behalf of consumers and the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. I've got a packet of information I'd like the page to distribute to the committee, if that's possible. And then I'd like to ask two people to come and testify, and I'd like to follow them up after their testimony is completed. And they're here and available. First is James Williams.
Could you pull your mic a little closer?
Sure. First is James Williams, and next would be Dr. David Katrosher. He'd be followed by Chris Messerly, and then I'll be last.
Welcome to the committee. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Please state your name for our tape.
Good afternoon. My name is James E. Williams. Distinguished Madam Chairwoman Boudreau, distinguished members of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify before you today on this vital issue that affects so many of our fellow citizens. I am here to speak in opposition to HF 1681, specifically as it relates to the limitation on damages provision set forth in the bill. My reasons are not political, they're not hypothetical or theoretical, but personal and actual and based upon real facts and real circumstances. My opposition to HF 1681 can be summed up in the following realities. Reality number one, the financial realities are simply overwhelming, and certainly the proposed cap does not even begin to address the real cost associated with a severely injured person suffering a catastrophic event. This will result in bankruptcy for many of our fellow citizens. Reality number two, a predetermined cap on damages sets the deck in that it determines the outcome before the hand is even played. Is this fair that some of our most powerful groups in our society, such as insurance companies, hospitals, and HMOs, deserve such privileged protection at the expense of ordinary citizens? Is this the type of social policy that we want our government to promulgate? Reality number three. If insurance companies do not bear the expense of fulfilling policies that they wrote, then the state will be forced to assume care of such severely injured persons. Do we want government to intervene and incur additional cost in times of severe budget constraints? And what type of care do you think these severely injured persons are going to get in such government institutions given the significant reduction in staff? And finally, reality number four. How do you determine the value of a relationship? Are all relationships worth $250,000, regardless of nature or duration? Why should government preempt the right of a judge or a jury trial in these cases when they don't do so in any other cases? Before I address the four realities that I just outlined above, I'd like to take just a few moments and tell you a very short story. On April 11th, the year 2000, Sharon Valencia Williams, a lady that I've been with since I was 14 and she was 12, and that I've been married to for 24 years, went to Fairview Riverside Hospital for an elective, routine, transvaginal hysterectomy due to fibrous tissue in her uterus. Now, the surgery was perfect, but while Sharon was in the recovery room, she was overdosed with morphine, her monitors were not connected, and the nurses left the recovery room to go out on a coffee break. While the nurses were out of the recovery room on a coffee break, the morphine caused Sharon's respirations to decrease and her tongue to fall back into her throat, causing her to smother. Sharon suffered respiratory arrest and subsequently cardiac arrest. Sharon's life was saved only when an anesthesiologist, not involved in her surgery, just happened to be walking through the recovery room and found her in distress. Sharon is presently a paraplegic, has limited consciousness, has very little ability to communicate, and needs round-the-clock care and attention. Now, I'd like to come back to the four realities that I outlined from the outset, and I'd like to discuss those in the context of how they have affected our family personally, and unfortunately, how it will affect thousands of fellow Minnesotans in the future. Reality number one, fat cap versus actual cost. As I alluded to earlier, the financial burden is simply enormous. And you can't predetermine the real costs due to ever-changing medical conditions of the patient, including treatments, therapies, surgeries, seen and unforeseen, and medications required on an ongoing basis. In addition, the ever-changing ongoing healthcare environment itself presents soaring medical costs, increased premiums, increased deductibles, as well as increased floor caps. For example, Sharon's medical expenses for the year 2003 were as follows. Payroll. Now, we have a staff of 14 nurses and aides that help take care of my wife 24 hours a day. One nurse and one aide, two 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, 12 months a year. Payroll. $344,606.34. Medical costs, which includes insurance premiums, medications, surgeries, and therapies not covered by insurance, $28,610.29. Transportation and supplies, $7,984.45. Rent, since we do not have my wife living in our home, we have a young teenager who was 13 at the time that this incident occurred, and it's had a dramatic impact, needless to say, on our family, but more particularly on my young son, since his mother and he were extremely close. Rent, $26,375.50. And finally, utility associated with that space, $2,402.03, for a grand total of $393,952.08. and that was for 1 year, for the year 2003. As you can see on its face, that capping the non-economic damages at $250,000 is not only laughable, but just patently unjust. Those who have suffered at no fault of their own will have to bear the cost of their condition. Reality number two, setting the deck. To set the deck and predetermine the outcome before the process even begins, it's just plain un-American and unfair. This is particularly so given the enormous disparity between the army of lawyers that represent the powerful institutions versus the ability of an ordinary citizen to obtain competent, courageous counsel to take them on. Let's be honest here. Do you really believe that a severely injured citizen will really obtain competent counsel if there's a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages? In our case, our attorney spent approximately 10,000 hours and incurred $250,000 in expenses to discover that the hospital had destroyed evidence, falsified records, had perjured testimony, and hid the only witness in the case for almost a year. If a cap were in place, all non-economic damages would be completely consumed by attorney's fees and expenses. And if these types of events could occur when there was no cap, what do you really think is going to happen if there is a cap? There will be no incentive for these institutions to deal fairly or attempt to settle cases, particularly when they know that the worst case scenario is going to be a $250,000 non-economic impact. In the meantime, institutions will defend these cases to the hilt, with additional hope to wear down their opponents, or even perhaps that the injured person will die before trial. Whatever happened to faith in our jury system? And are we to assume that the jury system works well for every other matter, except when it applies to medical malpractice cases? Reality number three. Should insurance companies or the state absorb the costs associated with such severely injured persons? Insurance companies are in the business of calculating and absorbing risk if they occur. They wrote the policies and collected the premiums, just as they do in any other catastrophic insured event. We don't legislate caps due to any other insurance risk. Why this one? And if the insurance companies do not fulfill their policies, and that obligation shifts to the state, I would submit that it is the wrong social policy for this distinguished institution to enact. The reasons are clear. Number one, it promotes irresponsibility because no one has to face up to the negligent event creating the damage. On the contrary, the liability system makes persons who injure others aware of their actions and provides incentives for them to act appropriately in the future. Number two, it shifts the financial burden of caring for such severely injured persons to the state without any corresponding or contributing dollars from the insurance company for such care. This will result in an even greater financial strain and further burden on the state. And number three, the state institutions that render care are under tremendous financial strain, resulting in being understaffed, overstressed, and underpaid. This continues to be an ever-increasing crisis not only in our state, but in our nation. Finally, reality number four. How do you determine the value of a relationship? Should it be based upon type, that is, husband-wife, mother-daughter, father-son? Does duration have any factor of bearing in that determination? Does the severely injured person have children, and if so, how many, and their ages? I would submit that these are questions for juries, not legislators. A cookie-cutter approach simply just won't do when it comes to the personal and particular variables involved in each distinct case. In our case, as I mentioned earlier, I've been with my wife since she was 14 and she was 12. I've been married to my wife for 24 years. We have two children. Should that be weighed the same as a marriage of a week, 10 years, 50 years? I don't know. And unless you can really examine each family's circumstances, particularly with all due respect, you won't know either. That's why we have juries to answer these tough questions. Finally, I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today on this vital issue and reiterate my opposition to HF 1681 as it relates to limitation on damage because, one, the proposed cap bears no reality to real costs. Medical costs continue to soar uncontrollably. So why should there be a cap? Number two, setting the deck is just simply un-American and unfair. It will result in your constituents losing or substantially impairing their ability to obtain competent, courageous counsel. It will also provide an incentive for the insurance companies to fight to the very end because they know the worst case scenario is a $250,000 non-economic impact. Number three, it will shift the financial burden for caring for such injured persons from insurance companies to the state, thereby exacerbating an already burdensome financial crisis. And finally, number four, juries are much better equipped to answer these tough questions associated with compensation values versus the legislature. In my opinion, at least with respect to the limitation of damage provision set forth in HF 1681, this is akin to a remedy in search of a problem. I thank you again. If there's any questions, I'll be more than willing to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. And I think I have heard your story before in a different committee, and it must be very difficult to deal with the situation that you've described. I just want to clarify that economic damages are not changed in this bill, and that does reflect some of the things that you had mentioned. And I'm not sure if you understood that or not, but the bill before us deals with non-economic damages and punitive damages. Those two are capped, but not the economic damages that...
Madam Chairwoman, I am aware of that. Okay. I think the economic damages set forth in the bill deal with verifiable costs. I am talking about costs which you cannot predetermine because you do not have any history. And even when you do have history, you can't rely on that history because those figures continue to change on an annual, not even an annual, almost a daily basis.
Okay. I think I just want to again clarify the economic damages is not changed. The cap is not, there's no cap on those. I just want to clarify that.
Madam Chairman and
Mr. Carlson.
Just so that we are clear, the care that Mrs. Williams received was at a nonprofit hospital, and there is a flat $300,000 limit on the damages that this family would collect, and it would never be exceeded under the language of House File 1681. And yes, he spoke about the non-economic losses, which are significant in this case, but their entire damages against the defendant that they were going against would be limited to $300,000 under this bill. Not just the non-economics, the economic damages as well. And all of the costs that he is talking about that would be shifted to the taxpayers in excess of $600,000 a year would be the result of the bill as it's drafted.
Then, Mr. Williams and Mr. Carlson, I misspoke, and I think we can continue that discussion. We can have that discussion. That's what this hearing is about. But I thank you. Is there questions for Mr. Williams? Seeing none.
I have no.
Representative Huntley, I'm sorry.
I was going to make the same point that this does put a cap of $300,000 in total expenses for a nonprofit hospital. And in this case, Mr. Williams and his wife would have only gotten $300,000 max, and despite the fact that it is costing $400,000 per year to keep her alive. And his family, if that cap had been there,
would be paying that difference. And I don't know what Mr. Williams' income is, but I would be surprised if it's $400,000 a year.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Respond.
Representative Huntley, thank you for that comment. I would tell you that my only job today is trying to get my family back. Formerly, I was president and chief executive officer of a private corporation here where I did not make $400,000, but my income was significant enough to be able to incur costs that were pending prior to our trial. So assuming that I would have continued to be in that position, our savings, all of our investments were almost completely exhausted. And I was a senior executive not only at a private corporation but also at a Fortune 50 company that was based in Minneapolis for many years. But my income did exceed $200,000 a year. But even at $200,000 a year, when you're incurring $400,000 of costs, it doesn't take long before the gas tank becomes empty. So I do appreciate that comment.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know what hospital's at, but if this would have happened to have occurred in one of our government-owned hospitals, the limits already apply. That apparently didn't happen here. The other question is, and I don't know what the lawsuit was like, but even with the provision about the hospital, that doesn't stop one from including in the lawsuits physicians and other professionals as individuals. Was your lawsuit strictly just against the hospital?
The lawsuit was against Fairview Riverside Hospital, as I said from the outset. It was solely against the hospital, solely against a recovery, against the nurse involved in the recovery room. As I indicated earlier, the surgery was perfect. So the only recourse we have would be against the institution itself.
Further questions? Comments? Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Thank you, members.
Dr. David. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is David Katroser. I have been a medical doctor, specifically a neurologist, for 22 years. I'm also an attorney, practicing primarily in the field of medical malpractice over the past 4 years. I continue to actively practice both professions, evaluating and treating patients, as well as representing clients harmed by medical malpractice every week. I was on the Medical Services Review Board for 12 years and was intimately involved in the writing of the treatment parameters that are used in Minnesota to control the diagnosis and treatment of work-related injuries. Finally, I have been sued for medical malpractice, fortunately, unsuccessfully. Based on my education and experiences, I believe I am qualified to contribute to this discussion. Concerning the best practice guidelines, I strongly urge the committee to eliminate that portion of this bill. Medical practice guidelines are already created by innumerable governmental and medical organizations and are routinely used now to guide jurors in determining the standard of care. Having written portions of just such a guideline, I can tell you that they are written to guide the provider's conduct under usual circumstances. But what a reasonable physician should do under the same or similar circumstances, which is the definition of the standard of care for physicians in Minnesota, depends on the facts of that patient's situation. Patients want that so that doctors treat them as unique individuals, not the average patient. That is what Minnesota law says is required of a healthcare provider, and why practicing medicine cannot be done by machines or on the basis of checklists. Concerning the limits on non-economic damages, I would also urge the committee to vote against its passage. There are certainly times when an injured person's non-economic damages are that amount or less, $250,000 or less. But that determination is the role of the jury. We trust juries to restrict our liberties, to resolve our disputes, and in some states, possibly in Minnesota in the future, to determine that we have forfeited our right to life. There is no evidence that Minnesota juries have abused that trust when determining appropriate non-economic damages for persons injured by negligent medical care. Remember that this does not restrict the damages for frivolous lawsuits. It restricts the damages after it has already been determined that the care was negligent and that negligent care harmed the person. To mandate that Susan McDougall only suffered $250,000 harm is unfair and borders on the obscene. Similar statements could be made about the harm suffered when a newborn child is made blind, retarded, and quadriplegic by a doctor's negligence. To say that the only harm that child suffered was the cost of their medical care implies we are nothing more than the sum of our component parts. In Minnesota, I thought we knew otherwise. This bill is not about frivolous lawsuits because it will only be used to limit the damages paid to persons hurt by jury-confirmed medical negligence. Frivolous claims don't encourage more lawsuits. They encourage attorney insolvency. Defendants don't pay nuisance suit value for medical malpractice cases in Minnesota. Insurers often tell me they would prefer to spend the money on defense attorneys because that doesn't encourage more lawsuits. Medical malpractice claims are expensive to pursue, often creating attorney out-of-pocket costs of $50,000 or more that are only recovered if there is a settlement or a plaintiff jury verdict. The result is that a successful medical malpractice attorney is one who only brings legitimate lawsuits, because those are the only ones with even a chance for payment. I know of no medical malpractice attorney with any experience who doesn't turn down 30 cases at least for every case that they'll accept. We heard earlier today about letters being written by attorneys after a person's involved in a motor vehicle accident. That does not occur in medical malpractice. You're turning down cases, you're not seeking them out. A case with only or primarily non-economic damages would never be brought under this bill. A disfiguring facial injury caused by medical negligence would not create a viable claim, though few would argue such a victim didn't deserve compensation. Despite all the gnashing of teeth and renting of garments, there were only 114 medical malpractice lawsuits filed in the entire state of Minnesota during the year 2000, and there is no indication that that has dramatically increased to the present time. There were more than 5,000 doctors in Minnesota at that time. That's about 1 in 40 doctors were sued that year. In a 40-year career, the average doctor would get sued once for a mistake they allegedly made that hurt their patient, and their insurer might, it's not certain, might have to pay for the harm they caused. Practicing medicine is harder than driving a car, so we make it harder to get a medical license than a driver's license. If someone drove for 40 years and only made one mistake that hurt someone, which would be covered by their car insurance, they'd probably get a good driver discount on their insurance. If they practice medicine for 40 years, it shouldn't be surprising that they might make one mistake that could hurt someone, their patient. They're human. We pay doctors a lot of money because they went to school a long time, work hard, and provide a valuable service. Holding them responsible for providing competent care is only reasonable. Their license requires them to provide it. Holding them responsible for the consequences of their negligent care is what the legal system is all about. Juries have a well-recognized bias in favor of doctors who are defendants that can sometimes, but not always, be overcome with sufficiently egregious facts. But success is never certain. If a jury identifies harm caused by a doctor's negligence, harming the injured person again when determining the award is nothing short of cruel. The malpractice insurers are not claiming that this bill will produce any reduction in malpractice premiums, nor did they claim that for similar federal legislation. They don't claim that this will significantly reduce total health care costs either. They just claim that this is somehow increasing health care costs, although there is evidence before you that it represents only a small fraction of 1% of total health care costs. Finally, Subdivision 7 appears punitive without purpose. The attorney advances the costs of medical malpractice litigation out of their own pocket, but this bill would make those advances further decrease the attorney's fee on a successful case. A case involving the death of a child or the death of a retired senior citizen would be capped most often at $250,000 damages, with $50,000 or more deducted for costs. The potential attorney's fee would be 40% of the first $50,000 or $20,000, one-third of the next $50,000 or about $16,200, and 25% after that. So that $250,000 capped case, the attorney would get less than $62,000 if they prevailed. They would have risked $50,000 to get that. No sane attorney would ever take a case in which they were risking as much as they were potentially, but not certainly, going to make. This legislation would prevent a family from holding a doctor responsible when the doctor's negligence caused the death of their loved one. If responsible behavior is what we want to encourage, this is a step backward. Plaintiff medical malpractice lawsuits are some of the most difficult in personal injury litigation because they require a detailed knowledge of a complex scientific field, have a highly regarded defendant, and already have additional rules and limitations. If laws are changed to decrease the compensation for these cases below other, easier legal work, no reasonable attorney will handle them. Attorneys' fees are traditionally higher in medical malpractice because they're harder cases, more costly cases, and fewer attorneys can and will do the work. We cannot justify greater damages when a person dies from negligence that causes a car accident than from the negligent hand of a trusted physician. If passage of this bill only caused harm to a group of attorneys, honestly, it's probably doubtful that much sympathy would arise, but it will also mean that many victims of medical negligence will lose their chance to seek a remedy, and that's just not right. I strongly urge the committee to not pass this bill. Thank you. I'm open to any questions.
Any questions? Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, I just had one question. Dr. Petrosius, is that?
It's right, sir.
Yeah. You had mentioned, I believe, that there were 127 cases filed in 2002 in Minnesota. That's on the fact sheet I have here.
On the fact sheet.
Dr. Petrosius, sir.
Thank you. On the fact sheet, it states there are 127 malpractice cases. What I said was that there were 114 medical malpractice cases in the year 2000. Malpractice cases includes legal malpractice, it includes accounting malpractice, it includes all malpractice. So that doesn't even indicate really that there is an increase.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Representative Ornis,
follow-up. Does that also include cases that were, say, settled out of court, where the insurance company just paid without having to go through the trial?
Dr. No. Cottrell, sir.
Neither of those numbers would include circumstances in which the insurers acknowledged up front that they needed to pay because their chances of winning at trial were not significant enough to make it worth the fight. When they acknowledge early on and settle before the lawsuit is brought, those wouldn't be included.
Representative Nornes.
Is there some way to find out what the number might be?
Dr. Cottrell.
Okay.
I'm sure that there is a way but it would require so many different organizations to pool their resources that I doubt without legislation it would ever happen.
Thank you.
Representative Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, you bring up a couple different, you kind of personalize it with some specific cases. And I think everybody around this table has a lot of compassion for what has happened to specific victims, whether it's someone losing two breasts when they shouldn't have, whether it's losing a child, whatever. How do you come to put a price tag on that? Ultimately, the person's never going to be made whole by any amount of money. You're never going to make up for what was done wrong. You don't like the $250,000 cap. You're with the trial lawyers. What cap would you accept? $1 million? $2 million? $5 million? $100 million? Is any cap acceptable?
Dr. Cottrell, sir.
I would see a cap as an attempt to make an individual situation fit into an arbitrary description. I don't think that we need to tell the jury what the answer to the question is that we are about to ask them. If we trust the jury to decide all of the important issues in our legal system, then we ought to trust them to decide this one too. This is a public policy decision whether we should and how much we should make the caps. But if you're going to make it based on public policy, do so with the understanding that this is not going to change the availability of health care because it will make it economically more feasible. It will make it affordable because this is not a significant portion of the cost of health care. This is going to increase the amount of money a very small number of malpractice insurers have. None of them are willing to say that it will lower premium. You've heard some testimony that it will lower, that it will because it lowered premiums in California. No, it didn't. MICRA was in effect with a $250,000 cap for many years with no lowering of the malpractice premiums. Those did not lower in California until insurance regulations were passed. Then it was lowered. So the caps have not been shown to lower it by themselves. This isn't going to, on a public policy basis, if that's your goal, make it affordable for people to get health care.
Representative Wilken.
I think that directly contradicts testimony we heard earlier today, because I do think, having been an underwriter, not for medical malpractice, but in other professional liability lines, that you look at this law, and this would significantly cap your risk on something where, you know, what we call the verticality of the risk, how much the dollar amount of the settlement could shoot up. If you can control that somewhat, you can reasonably slow the rate of growth in your premiums. And what scares me is the kind of the cavalier attitude of the Bar Association and not really worrying about if we have access to emergency health care. I'll tell you what, our constituents are going to be worried about that when some of the emergency facilities start shutting down.
Can I respond?
Dr. Cottrell, you may respond.
You heard earlier today from the emergency room physician that although the rates for medical malpractice in many, maybe most, specialties in Minnesota are at the lowest portion for our country, they're not for the emergency room. That tells us that we're not looking at runaway juries. That tells us that we're not looking at greedy lawyers. And that tells us that we're not looking at unreasonable plaintiffs. That tells us that there's something about the way emergency care is being provided in Minnesota where there is more malpractice happening than in the other specialties, and they're causing more harm than in the other specialties in relationship to other parts of the country. basically what's happening is they're being told over and over again they're not providing very good care, and their response is to eliminate being responsible for providing bad care, not to try to improve that care to at least the level that's found elsewhere in this country. Our juries aren't the problem, and the runaway verdicts aren't the problem. The problem is bad care.
I think,
Mr. Representative Wilkin,
I think maybe the problem is that the trial lawyers have very easy access to the patient list with emergency rooms because there's usually police reports. I mean, Representative Samuelson got how many letters from plaintiff's lawyers after a simple accident? I mean, there is a difference in access to your clientele when you're talking about emergency room physicians versus a doc in the box.
But Dr. Katroser, are you alleging that our emergency care services are not to the level they should be?
I'm certainly alleging that if their experience, being sued more often, being jury-confirmed causes of more damage than in other parts of the country, that indicates that they're not providing a level of care.
For us have been general liability insurance and vehicle liability insurance. The
consistent with the care required by their peers, as you know, is found elsewhere. As far as the access in the emergency room, you're mixing apples and oranges. The access to emergency room visits is not access to emergency room visits. That would be a breach of confidentiality that could absolutely never occur. What you're looking at is evidence that people were in motor vehicle accidents, which is, according to law, reported through the police. If a person gets in a car accident, doesn't report to the police, and goes to the emergency room, that will not appear. They will not be deluged with the letters from the personal injury attorneys for motor vehicle accidents, and that has absolutely nothing to do with malpractice.
That's not what I said. What I said was the more serious cases that go into emergency rooms are usually the result of some kind of accident where there might be a police report. I'm not talking about, and you know those aren't, you know, those people aren't being transferred to the little clinic with the family practice doc down the street. They're going to the hospital. And that's the point of what I said. That's where they control for more clients, looking through the police records.
It is a
Dr. Katroser.
Thank you. It is a minuscule part of medical malpractice that has any relationship to a person being involved in a motor vehicle accident. Minuscule to almost non-existent. You're talking almost exclusively about people who go in for anything from a heart attack to elective surgery to an infection to any of the thousand other reasons people go to the emergency room. Motor vehicle accidents, can it occur? Sure. Can you have malpractice because somebody is in a car accident, then they go to the hospital and they really roll snake eyes and they have bad luck twice in the same day? Sure, that can occur. But it's not a career move for any lawyer who does medical malpractice to check the motor vehicle accident lists.
Okay. I know we have other testifiers. If there's no further questions right now for Dr. Katroser, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Joel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. With the indulgence of the committee, we had some witnesses who were scheduled to testify here at 4:30 when they could get off of work when they got the phone call that the hearing had been moved up.
Mr. Gillay indicated to me that they would be given an opportunity to come back. One of the lucky lottery winners of Dr. Goschwitz is Linda McDougal, is an accountant, and she has to go to work, and she couldn't take the time off to come over here and testify at noon, but she would like to be here at 9 o'clock on, or excuse me, at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, as was offered. If there's an additional time, she's committed to be here at that time. But if there's
Mr. Carlson, time, there's also the opportunity for her to submit some written testimony, and
sure,
perhaps that could be part of it, and we'll be assured that that would be distributed to the committee.
We have two additional witnesses similar to Linda, different circumstances, that would be here at that time whenever you afford us that opportunity, that couldn't be here at noon, could have been here at 4:30.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, the problem we have is with a conflict with another event this afternoon.
Well, and I understand why.
In attempting to reschedule that a couple of days ago,
sure,
we'll accommodate your witnesses by dispersing their written testimony at a future hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I'd like to just talk a little bit about medical malpractice insurance, some of the documents that we put in the record for the committee, and some of the facts about medical negligence in Minnesota. First of all, Representative Nornes, as to your question, that is a knowable question. There are not a significant number of settlements, if any, in Minnesota that are not tracked through the civil court system. And the number of 127 malpractice cases, which includes accountant malpractice, attorney malpractice, is, we believe, almost the entire field of malpractice. We've talked a lot about Linda McDougal. Her case had to be sued out. That's a pretty clear-cut case of malpractice, and that case is in suit. If you think they are settling cases without having them put into litigation, that simply just doesn't happen in Minnesota. And the reason it doesn't happen is we have a requirement in Minnesota that as a condition precedent to filing a medical malpractice case, you have to review the facts of that case with an expert who would be qualified to testify, and he will say, prior to your filing a case in Minnesota, that the standard of care has been deviated. That's been the law since 1986 in Minnesota. And I can assure you that without that affidavit, insurers are not settling cases because they're going to put you through your hurdles. You don't have that requirement if you're not in suit. And so every case that that we think has merit gets filed in court. So there are very few that are simply settlements. And I'll also tell you that the Board of Medical Practice keeps, by law, a tracking system of settlements and jury verdicts at the Board of Medical Practice, and I can tell you that number is less than the 127 each year. Their last biannual report, I think, showed 80 settlements or verdicts in malpractice cases reported to the board in each of their years that they tracked the biennium. So that's consistent with the number of cases that we're seeing in suit. If there were hundreds more, they are still required to be notified at the Board of Medical Practice, and they are not showing up there. Malpractice insurance in Minnesota, members, is among the lowest in the country. And despite the claims that we've heard from the insurance industry, I want you to know that a damage limitation similar to what's been in place in California since 1975 does not reduce premiums, it does not increase access to care, and nor does it hold down the increases in malpractice insurance rates. I've given the committee a memo that goes through not something that the trial lawyers put together or a consumer group, but something put together by the Medical Liability Monitor, which is an insurance journal that tracks the insurance rates that are charged for different medical practices, lines of practice throughout the country. And every year for the past 13 years, they put out a state-by-state report of the rates that are published by the insurers for malpractice in all 50 states. And I've given you a comparison of Minnesota's rates based on the Medical Liability Monitor. And you can see that internal medicine in Minnesota, the average rate of roughly $4,100 compares to California, who's had a $250,000 damage limitation since 1975, is almost three times less. General surgery, similar, and OBGYN, a little more than three times less. As you can see, the cap on damages does not have an impact on the liability premiums that the doctors are proving, and that's from the insurance industry. That's our experience, and that's California's experience. You clearly cannot say that their rates are lower, as has been represented to this committee. You can also not say, Madam Chairman and members, that that a cap on damages has any impact on the growth in your premium. Just using Minnesota and California as a comparison, you can see that California had significantly higher increases in their malpractice insurance rates than what Minnesota has experienced. Not only is that the case, if you look at, this is from year to year, from 2002 to 2003, if you compare that number over a 10-year period, Minnesota's rates have been essentially stagnant and only have gone up in the last couple of years after 9/11, and California has experienced larger than average increases than even the entire country. And they've had much higher increases than states without damage limitations. You cannot make the case that a damage limitation in Minnesota, which only applies to cases where there are provable damages in excess of the cap, is going to have a corresponding reduction in malpractice premiums, or is it going to have any corresponding reduction in health care costs? I've sat here through the testimony throughout the fall and through your committee, and I haven't seen anybody yet come up here and say that that limitation is going to reduce costs. It just, I'm waiting for someone to say to the committee that the $4,100 premium that the general medicine doctor is paying is going to be reduced by half or by 10 cents. I haven't heard that, and I've been waiting for it. Additionally, the specialty groups, which are not part of the medical liability monitor, may have an individual problem. I think it's partly because, as they testified, that the Midwest Medical Insurance Corporation that was covering the emergency room docs dropped all ER practice groups that weren't at an affiliated hospital. The insurance company themselves dried up that market for whatever reason, but that wasn't a result of claims. They've come before you witness after witness and said, we've had zero or no claim history, we've had little claim history at best, and to say that this is driven by litigation or would be fixed by a cap on litigation just doesn't seem to be the case, and in particular with emergency room docs. If you take what their premium is from Dr. Goswich, he testified at your hearing 2 weeks ago that the premium he secured was $1.2 million, a big number. That covers all of their physicians, which I don't have an exact number. Somebody said 134. I have heard 103. It's less than $10,000 per ER physician. Not that that's not a staggering number or a big number, but it is not a crisis. It just simply is not a crisis. And to suggest that our ER docs are moving to California, I think doesn't comport with the truth. I handed out a memo from the American Medical Association that indicates that California has closed 60 emergency rooms. 60 emergency rooms in California with MICRA in the last 10 years. It's not a result of malpractice, malpractice insurance or malpractice claims. It's the result of uncompensated care from the reimbursement rates that they get. That is what is impacting the emergency room physicians. So I would think about selling my house before I'm going to move to California, because they are asking their legislature in California for an additional in excess of $500 million to pay for the uncompensated care, and that's what's closing their practices down. It has nothing to do with their liability premiums. To put it in perspective as to the cost, Madam Chair and members, in 2000, according to both the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and Insure.com, a site that tracks insurance issues. About $19 million was paid out to all victims of medical malpractice in Minnesota. That same year, the CEO of United Healthcare collected $58 million himself. That's just one individual. To suggest that someone like James Williams goes bankrupt and his family becomes impoverished over an error that was not caused by them under these economic circumstances is an injustice. And I will tell you that this legislature passed a limitation on damages in 1986. And they repealed it. This legislature repealed that limitation of $400,000. They repealed that in 1990 after lengthy study because they found two things. Number one, it didn't do anything to reduce anybody's costs. And number two, it only impacted the most severely injured families in Minnesota. And it was unanimously repealed by this legislature. As a method of controlling health care costs, I suggest that this limitation is a solution in search of a problem in Minnesota. And we've talked a lot about evidence-based medicine and basing our care on science. And I think if you apply the facts and the science to this provision, it would be impossible to come to a conclusion that this is going to save costs now or into the future. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know Representative Wilkin, I think I have an answer for the question that you asked. But I appreciate you being here and letting additional witnesses come when they can be available.
Mr. Carlson, does this conclude any witnesses for today?
For today.
Okay. Questions? Comments? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I think, a very important topic, and it's gotten a little personal from some people, and I hope that we can make a point to keep to the data. And I mean, it's there's just... I can just sense the tension in it, and there's just pain and suffering from the people who are injured and fear on the part of the docs. And I think, as I said earlier, that nobody wants to hurt anybody in any of these situations, and stuff happens. How do you resolve it? That's what we're about here. But I do have a question. Mr. Carlson, can you or somebody get us some data on emergency room physician malpractice rates? We've got some stuff about the other rates, but it seemed like it would be interesting to have California's information and Minnesota's information going back 6 or 8 years, just so we can kind of see what, and I don't think anybody's, you know, not telling the truth. They just have perspectives that may be limited by their own experience. So I'd like to see the real numbers. So thank you.
And
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Ehler, I would like to see that as well. I would like to see the numbers and the premiums paid and the losses paid out. And we will search to get that for other specialty groups, but I can tell you that they are not readily available. If the hostilities on my part, I sincerely apologize, but having doctors come here and tell us that their patients are lottery winners is offensive to me when I deal with those people every day.
Madam Chair.
We only have about 40 minutes left, and we need to allow time for the other testifiers. So, Representative Abler, can you make it very brief?
Just to follow up, I think that's, to me, the emergency room, it seems like that's at least where one of the very important piece of data we need to have to make any good decisions. So I hope that if Mr. Carlson can't find it, staff or researcher, somebody can find that for us.
Madam Chairman,
Mr. Carlson,
one of the witnesses that testified at the previous hearing had, I think, some really telling information. He had a practice group, I believe, of 35 physicians, and he purchased his insurance through RJUA, which was also created in 1986. At a cost of, I believe he said, $220,000. He said at a reasonable cost. He would have maybe liked to have had more coverage. But we can get that information from our joint underwriting authority, because you only get to the JUA when there is no availability of other insurance in the marketplace. And I believe a request from a legislator to the JUA to get that information would make it available to you.
Thank you. Dr. Richard Geyer. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Richard Geyer. I'm a surgeon with the Olmsted Medical Center in Rochester. I'm chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA represents over 9,000 physicians and medical students from across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about the need for medical liability reform in Minnesota.
Dr. Geyer, could you adjust your mic? It's difficult to hear you. Okay, just kind of close to you. Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I also serve as chairman of the board of Midwest Medical Insurance Company, the physician-owned professional liability insurance company here in Minnesota. Today, however, I'm speaking on behalf of the MMA. The MMA strongly supports the reforms to the medical liability system proposed in HF 1681. These reforms have been proven in other states to be the most effective in controlling the costs of professional liability. I'm sure you're aware that rapidly rising professional liability insurance premiums have triggered a crisis that has devastated health care in several states and continues to spread to others. According to the American Medical Association, 19 states are now in full-blown crisis, affecting access to care, especially obstetrical and emergency care. Another 25 states in Minnesota, including Minnesota, are considered to be at high risk. Premiums approaching $300,000 per year are causing disruptions in availability of medical services. Physicians are closing practices, avoiding providing emergency care, obstetrics, and certain procedures that carry higher risks of being sued, and are moving from high-risk states to lower ones. Medical students are increasingly concerned about malpractice suits, and a recent survey shows that half are choosing their specialty partly on its propensity for being sued. What will this do for our future supply of obstetricians, emergency physicians, neurosurgeons, and even my own replacement? The primary driver of escalating insurance premiums is a sudden, rapid rise in claims payments. From 1995 to 2001, the average claim payment increased 80% nationally, and the expense of dealing with claims about doubled. The percentage of claims closed for over $1 million more than tripled in those 5 years, from 2.6 to 7.9. For MMIC, the average payment for paid claims capped at $1 million, that is, the part not affected by reinsurance, almost doubled from 1997 to 2001. 2001, incidentally, was the first year that MMIC had a loss. The main cause of the increase has been a rash of large jury awards out of proportion to actual damages sustained. In 2000, 2001, 2002, nearly all medical malpractice insurers lost money. Several went out of business. Several stopped insuring medical malpractice. The insurers that remained had a reduced financial capacity and yet had to take on the physicians whose insurers were no longer there, stressing the surviving companies. Minnesota has been lucky so far, but we are not immune. Crises in several states have come on quite suddenly. A rash of bad losses suddenly drives up insurance rates or makes some specialties virtually uninsurable. A single judicial decision can have unanticipated multi-million-dollar implications. Reinsurers see their risks escalate and increase their premiums accordingly. Even in Minnesota, we have seen some recent eight-figure jury awards. After several years of stability, MMIC's base rates in Minnesota have risen 21.7% in the past 3 years. Not huge by national standards, but a lot more than physician payments have increased. And many physicians in high-risk specialties, including mine, have seen much higher boosts, more than that in a single year. The other major insurers in the state raised their base rates 20 and 25% in 2003 alone, just last year. There is a mention of 114 suits being filed. That's the tip of the iceberg. MMIC alone had 506 claims last year. That doesn't include our competitor insurance companies, and it doesn't include the self-insured entities like Mayo, Park, Nicollet, Duluth, St. Mary's, Alina, Health Partners, and so on. About a third of the claims end up in payments. So MMIC alone had more payments than the amount listed here, or mentioned by a previous speaker. Already, emergency groups in the Twin Cities are unable to find standard insurance. They have to go into the Joint Underwriting Association. The coverage is limited, but the premiums are higher. The speaker said that emergency room doctors were dropped without having any claims. And NIC doesn't drop people that we make money on. That's ridiculous. It wouldn't take much of a climate change to push all Minnesota physicians and their patients into the same reality that others are currently facing. By that time, it would be too late. After a crisis hits, even if the legislature should pass the ideal legal changes, it takes several years for the courts to rule on constitutional challenges and for insurers to see the results. By then, much damage has already been done. The time to act is before the crisis, when you can deal with the problem calmly and in time to prevent trouble. HF 1681 includes provisions to help Minnesota avert a crisis that could affect the availability of care. First, it caps non-economic damages at $250,000. It imposes no limits on actual damages such as medical costs, future care, lost income, and so on. This is the most effective proven way to reduce costs of professional liability. There have been several studies showing reductions in costs ranging from 17% to 30%. The highest figure coming from the American Academy of Actuaries that said that states with premiums and with premium caps, or states with caps, had premiums in 2002 that were on average 30% lower than states without. One commonly quoted study has been debunked. It's one that shows no differences. But in that study, they included as states with caps, states that had just recently passed caps that had not had a chance to take effect, and states with high caps that have been shown to be ineffective. Non-economic damages are impossible to measure. There are no standards for them. They are therefore impossible to predict. Insurers have to be able to predict the likelihood and the amount of losses to be able to set premiums. Capping the awards for unquantifiable damages provides some predictability and thereby helps to stabilize premiums. HF 1681 also establishes a sliding scale on attorney contingency fees, which directs a larger portion of large awards to injured patients. These two items, a cap on non-economic damage awards and limits on contingency fees, were two of the key ingredients in California's tort reforms in 1975. Since then, the professional liability premiums in California have increased at a third the national rate. The speaker said that a whole bunch of emergency rooms closed in California in the last 10 years. A whole bunch of emergency rooms closed in Minnesota in the last 10 years, too, as the hospitals closed. I think that's a non sequitur along with some of the other comments on California. Sure, California's rates are higher than Minnesota's rates. There's probably more malpractice in California, and there's a different culture in California. You have to compare California to California, and their rates have increased at a third the national rate. Minnesota should not wait until a trauma center closes like in Nevada, or until pregnant women are left without doctors to deliver them as in Utah and West Virginia. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I urge you to adopt the reforms contained in HF 1681. I thank you for your consideration. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Geyer. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Geyer, thank you for your testimony. One question, and I think you might be able to be best the testifiers to answer this. We're hearing a lot of terminology here thrown around it that's fairly similar, and I'd just like to run these and have you define a couple things for me. We hear best practices, evidence-based medicine, and standard of care. Are they interchangeable? Separate things?
Sorry.
Dr. Geyer.
Yes. There are two sets of things there. Standard of care is something that's used as a basis for malpractice. It's not really used medically, I don't think, very much. But practice guidelines, there are several synonyms for that, but those are based on evidence on medicine. What happens is a committee of doctors will get together, look at studies on a given topic,
and try to come up with, for the typical case, what's the progress that you make, what order do you do tests, treatments, and so on, and try to get what are also called clinical pathways to standardize the care as much as possible, knowing that not every patient is standard and not every patient is going to be treated in the same way. What is proposed in this bill essentially is that if there are practice guidelines that are adopted by, I think it's the health department, that these would constitute an absolute defense against saying that you departed from standard of care. That would basically define them as the standard of care.
Representative Powell.
And a second question. Now, we just had a physician on the last panel state and allege that emergency physicians, for one, because they're having difficulty getting malpractice insurance, must be offering substandard care. I'd give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Yeah, I think that's not true. He also alleged that, or implied at least, that the care by emergency room physicians in Minnesota was worse than in other states. I think that's not true either. One of the problems with emergency medicine is that you're dealing with patients who have bad things happen to them unexpectedly, and they are dealing with a physician that they don't know. The family doctor that's been taking care of your family for the last 20 years is a lot less likely to get sued than a doctor that you don't know. You come in with something bad, you're not happy to be there in the first place, then something else goes bad, some complication, and much more prone to be sued.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Garr, thank you for making a trip here today. Thank you for your testimony. I could have thought maybe that you were actually testifying to the other side because you're featured in the opponent's literature. And I would like to have you have a chance to sort of react to that. I think the thing that we've been told about NMIC, and you're quoted as saying that South Dakota and Minnesota rank first and second respectively in the country for having the lowest premiums. That's one of the, and I don't know whether I question the fact or anything. And then I think, secondly, we've heard quotes about NMIC returning money to their shareholders or to people who have, I can't remember which one it was, as sort of an indication, I think, in both cases that alleges that that medical malpractice is not a problem. I think you sort of said it, but if you could just sort of react, put these kinds of things in context, I'd appreciate it.
Dr. Geyer.
Yes. Minnesota and South Dakota do rank as the lowest two in the country. South Dakota does have a cap, and they beat Minnesota. Partly that's due to cultural factors, partly it's due to the quality of care. But we have seen a deterioration just in the last few years, last two or three years, and it's come on fairly quickly. And that's what has us concerned. As far as dividends back to policyholders, MMIC is owned by its physician policyholders. And so if there are any, you know, if the premiums are set too high for a given year, as it turns out that we don't have to pay out as much as we think we're going to, then those excesses are returned to the policyholders. There have not been any dividends in the past 2 years. We had dividends for several years in a row prior to that.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Dr. Geyer, and don't think I'm picking on you because I'm going to ask this to virtually everyone that comes down here. Number one, can you give me an example of the outrageous overpayment to anybody that is sued in the state of Minnesota?
I think,
Dr. Geyer.
Okay. There have been some, like I said, eight-figure jury awards recently. I don't know the details of the actual losses in those cases, but I think that if you look at those, the losses will be, the economic damages that were alleged would be considerably less than the overall award.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Dr. Geyer, the woman that had two breasts removed by mistake, if we pass this bill, she would get a maximum of $300,000 for both the medical expenses and the pain and suffering and economic damages. what are having two breasts removed by mistake worth, and why are you a better person to make that decision than a jury of that woman's peers?
Dr. Geyer.
Well, first, that's not true. She would not be limited to $300,000 total. The hospital would only be liable for $300, but the two pathologists and their corporation would only be limited to $250,000 non-economic damages, but her economic damages would be totally paid. As far as what are two breasts worth, that's part of our problem, is we don't have a system for determining what anything is worth unless it can be measured in dollars and cents. The ancient Babylonians, the ancient Anglo-Saxons in England had a system for that, but the United States doesn't. And that's what makes it unpredictable. But if she were terribly disfigured in an industrial accident, even if her employer were grossly negligent, she'd get nothing for pain and suffering.
Representative Otremba. Oh, you didn't? Oh, sorry, you're on the list. Do you have any comments? It could be. Any other questions for Dr. Geyer? Seeing none. Thank you, Dr. Geyer. Dr. Dean. Dr. Laura Dean is coming. Good afternoon. Please state your name.
My name is Laura Dean, and thank you. Am I speaking into the microphone?
You're good.
Distinguished members of the panel and Madam Chair, thank you for having me here today. I would like to qualify by saying I have never testified for anything, and I'm usually best one-on-one talking to my patients in an exam room. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist that practices medicine in Stillwater, Minnesota. And I am here because I feel very strongly about the high quality of medical care that we have here in the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to address the growing problems with professional liability issues and reform. I was born and raised in this state, and I had the privilege of being educated here as well. I received an outstanding medical education at Mayo Medical School in Rochester and did my advanced training in obstetrics and gynecology here at the University of Minnesota. We Minnesotans enjoy the highest quality of medical care in the country. I had the opportunity to interact with my colleagues from across the United States. Because I have served in a volunteer capacity with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and have been most recently appointed to a committee on quality assurance and patient safety. Physicians are concerned about quality and patient safety. My perspectives come from three points. I am here first as a patient, second as a wife and mother of three children, and third as a physician who cares for women and has delivered more than 1,200 babies in the Stillwater area. The last one was about 2.5 hours ago.
Oh, my. Dr. Dean, was it a boy or a girl?
It was a boy. I have listened to the testimony of the people that have preceded me, and I am well aware of the crisis brewing in medical care across the country. I have colleagues who have moved out of Pennsylvania. I have friends who have stopped delivering babies in Nevada. And as I watch things happening across the country, what I would caution the group gathered here today is Minnesota currently is not in a crisis. But if we don't do something proactively, we will soon be in that position. The reason I think it's important to identify and discuss these issues is because patient access to quality care will be affected if people, speaking as an obstetrician gynecologist, if physicians stop delivering babies, and who is going to take care of these women who are going to deliver these babies. In my community in Stillwater, there are 5 of us who deliver babies. My family practice colleagues have long since given up the practice. Recently, in our state, outstate hospitals, both Two Harbors and Blue Earth, have stopped providing obstetrical services, and those women need to travel much longer distances to receive the care that they need. I also see the stress on my colleagues. I have been practicing for 8 years, and I have friends, physicians who have stopped delivering babies and physicians who have stopped providing hospital-based care because of the stresses, the pressures, and the lack of support for some of these issues. As those talented people are no longer available to care for patients, some patients aren't getting the access or the quality care they need. I also serve on the board of directors at my clinic, and in the last, each of the last 2 years, our medical professional liability costs have gone up almost 50% each of the last 2 years, and now we also have a $50,000 deductible for each incident that's reported. And I did go and check with my office and ask what my professional liability insurance cost this year. 2 years ago, it was less than $20,000. This year, it's $30,900. And that's a change in 2 years. Now, I will state that we do have some of the lowest costs nationwide at this time, but we are seeing a trend and an increase. My concerns in the practice of medicine are quality, safety, access, and cost. The culture of defensive medicine affects all of these factors by lowering quality, decreasing access, driving up costs, and driving physicians from the practice of medicine. As we see changes in the liability climate, my colleagues have stopped providing obstetrical service. My colleagues have stopped providing hospital-based services like emergency medicine and surgery, and some colleagues have stopped providing medical care altogether. Meaningful reform is needed to protect patient access to quality health care. We have a standard of excellence in this state. I am proud to be a part of it. I love what I do. I enjoy taking care of my patients, and delivering babies is a privilege. But there are increasing pressures mounting that are affecting the ability to provide that care. Thank you for this opportunity to be here. I would be happy to answer questions that anyone might have.
Representative Bidner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Doctor, for coming. And I appreciate your enthusiasm for your work, and I'm sure your patients are very fortunate to have you be a part of their delivery and stuff, so that's good.
Thank you.
We're up to our neck with this topic, and we've heard all kinds of reasons why premiums are going up, ranging from 9/11 to stock market losses, to recovery of reserves, to actually unwise investments I think insurance companies have made sometimes, what they're recouping, and all kinds of things. And you're suggesting to us that if we put this cap on these damages, that'll be a help. Do you think it will be? What else? This is not the magic bullet, I don't think. And do you have a... I'm not sure it's going to do very much at all, frankly, and it may cause harm. But if that would help, you think it will. But what else could we do in your world to help control these liability premiums?
Dr. Dean, I think that's the question we're all here to answer. So I certainly will address the fact that I do think caps will make a difference and have shown a difference in other states. But it is only one part. I wish I could sit in front of you and tell you that I have the solution to this problem. I certainly think what I am trying to do as a physician and as a community member is certainly acting from my physician side. I don't wear the cap of an administrator or in that fashion, but from my side, I am focusing on patient safety, quality assurance, and will continue to work on those efforts in my spare time and with my colleagues. And I will assure you from my side that we will continue to try to improve those things so that we decrease injury and harm.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
And do you feel that you're doing, you feel like you're forced to do procedures you would never do except you're concerned about malpractice? And the second part of that, then I think my question's all at once because I'll answer all at once. But and then the second part of that is that do you feel that some of the procedures you have to hurry through because you're under the burden of time and managed care challenges hamper some of the relationship you want to develop with your patients?
Dr. Dean, well, those are excellent questions. What I would say is, unfortunately, probably every hour of every day, this issue is on the back of my mind. When I was on call Monday night managing 4 labor patients, one of the patient's husbands said to me, well, when do you think you're going to do a C-section? Because we thought we'd have the baby by now. And things were going beautifully. We later had a beautiful vaginal birth. But the fact that people are asking this question, you talk them through, you explain what's happening, that mom and baby are doing well, but this patient has the expectation, or this patient's husband, that I should be doing something differently. It's, people challenge things that they don't understand as well, but it affects how I practice medicine. I think about it every minute of every day. Now, my first goal is quality. I pride myself in the attention that I pay to my patients. I do see probably less patients than some so that I allow appropriate time, but do I feel the pressures? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Dean, for coming here, and I know you have a busy schedule. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much.
Representing the hospitals, David Feinwax. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members, my name is Dave Feinwax. I am General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing all of Minnesota's hospitals. I would like to begin this afternoon by saying that we support and embrace the concepts contained in House File 1681. We know that this is a difficult issue to address, and we are grateful that the authors have the courage and the fortitude to take this issue on. I know you've heard a great deal of testimony today. I'd like to begin by pointing out something that a colleague gave me. The Journal of Health Affairs for January 2004, which is a policy journal for healthcare, indicates that an analysis of insurance premiums shows that in states that cap awards, the premiums are 17.1% lower than states which do not, and this study is 2-3 weeks old. Let me say a couple of...
Mr. Feinwax, do you have a copy of that you could give to the committee later?
I will have this duplicated this very afternoon and distribute it, Madam Chair. Let me say a couple of things. One of the elements of discussion this afternoon was, should we put a monetary cap on something that we cannot assign a price to? And I think the answer to that is yes, for a very logical reason. And should this body of elected accountable officials be the ones to do that? I think the answer is yes. An allusion was made earlier to our workers' compensation system. We have in the law various models, including workers' comp, where we balance the needs of the injured with the needs of other entities such as employers to create a system, not perfect, but as good as humans are capable of, to provide for adequate compensation without damaging employers. If we do this in the employee-employer arena, why shouldn't we do it to protect the healthcare infrastructure while attempting to achieve the same level of justice? Secondly, the concept of should there be a cap on damages for nonprofit hospitals. Well, for 41 hospitals in the state, as was pointed out earlier, there currently is. Is this body the correct body to take that up? Yes, it is. What should the dollar amount be? That's a more difficult question. And we would be pleased to work with the authors as well as others if there is some significant debate about whether or not that is an adequate amount. Our concern is not so much focused on the dollar, but rather on the concept, the notion that there should be a limit. The world is not a stagnant place. 50 years ago, you couldn't sue a not-for-profit organization. In recent years, we've seen some dramatic increases. I know earlier, Representative Huntley asked a witness to provide an example of an egregious situation. One that comes to mind for me is, I believe, last year or the year before, a nonprofit organization that owned an ambulance which arrived 3 or 4 minutes late to assist someone was awarded damages of like $11 million, and I believe that was upheld. Most of us consider that to be fairly egregious. We have done this for the victims of 9/11. It is something that we need to do. As I say, it is a difficult task, but we support the work of this committee and the author of the bill, and I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Feinwax, we're actually all here for the same thing. We want a better health care system, and we want a better way to pay for it. And currently, about half of the physicians in the state work for hospital systems, so they're employees of hospital systems. And if that woman that had both breasts removed had been at one of these hospitals, and if this bill passed and the pathologist worked for the hospital, she would have been capped at $300,000 total. So again, my question is, what are two breasts worth in terms of pain, suffering, economic damage, medical costs, and why are you a better person to make that decision, or why is the legislature a better group of people to make that decision than a jury of peers that would listen to all the arguments about the person's family, lifestyle, and so on?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Feinwax.
My response to that, and I will try to answer the questions as best I can. First, in 41 hospitals, that would indeed be the result without this legislation, either yesterday or today or tomorrow. However, in the case you refer to, the factual situation was that the hospital was not at fault and was not sued, and that woman would recover everything. And if this bill was law, as Dr. Geyer pointed out, the only limitation would be on the non-economic damages, and there would be a limitation involved there. To the perhaps most important part of your question, why is this group the group to make that decision? Why should this be done legislatively? Someone has to do it. And from my perspective, I think that elected officials who are charged with evaluating this and who serve as a counterbalance to the court in our system of checks and balances are better equipped to make this decision than a group of 12 randomly chosen individuals, or even worse, a group of 12 individuals chosen with a specific bias by people carefully trained to choose them.
Representative Huntley, follow up.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think I'm prepared to make that decision. I don't know why I would know more about it before a case came, and I knew know nothing about the individual involved, know nothing about the family involved, know nothing about their financial situation. I can tell you when we get to the end of this, I'm going to tell you what would happen to me. Yeah, if you know, something happened to me that cost $600,000 a year to keep me alive, I'll go through a little scenario on how long that would last. So the question is, who pays? Does the patient that was injured pay, or does society pay? And we better decide on that issue.
Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, we've been asked to vote on the value of Representative Huntley today.
No, we will not ask. Yes.
Mr. Feinwax, I have two things, Madam Chair. Well, you've heard a lot of discussion about rates. Are you in a position to provide us, not now, but with some rates of what you know about ERs, the trend? And it seems like some of these numbers are available, some are not. And I have a second question, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, let me say this. First, I will say that I don't have statistics, so part of what I'm going to say immediately is sort of a visceral reaction. But my reaction is that Minnesota's emergency room doctors, if not the finest in the nation, are certainly among the finest in the nation. The care here is in no way substandard, and I will produce people or written evidence to attest to that. The problem with emergency room medicine is that for the emergency room physician, they are but one standard deviation removed from the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan law encourages physicians to treat people, you know, on the roadway. Well, when you're brought into an emergency room after an accident, the difference is you've got some fancy equipment, but as a previous witness has testified to, you've got a physician who's never seen the patient before, a patient who is frequently seriously injured, and a patient who's not in a position to communicate well. And to hold those physicians to the same standard as if they've been the treating physician of the patient for 20 years is just wrong.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Feinwachs, and anybody else who can get me these numbers, I agree with everything you said. But it would really help to see the math about where the numbers are for if it's going up so much, and I believe it sounds like it is, and we've heard lots of reasons why, ranging from investments to everything else. But Madam Chair, it occurs to me part of what we're barking up here is maybe even the whole wrong tree. I think part of what's going on in the malpractice world is our doctors are now strangers to us. Over the last 15 and 20 years, we now have Revolve a Doc. You go on and, well, who's on call? Oh, I've never met you, but okay, can you help me with my problem? And that's a function of what we've helped create in our system. We now have hardly any insurers, and we have doctors we don't know. The ER docs are I think they're extremely highly competent and well-trained and are the admiration of our country, but they don't know the people at all. And so that's the epitome of it, but I think the good doctor who testified, the OB woman who was here, I think she'll never be sued. She allows time. She underbooks herself consciously so she can be sure to give each person the attention that they would like, and in her system it's not allowed anymore. And I think that as we try to figure out what's going on, and I think that it occurred to me in our hearing today, this is, I think, a piece. I don't know how you capture it, but I think there's a part of that which we're losing, and we're not saving any money. We're paying for it in liability premiums and in harm or perceived harm, and there's somewhere to go there. I'm just thank you, Madam Chair, for the chance to talk.
Any final comments, Mr. Feinwachs?
I don't disagree.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, we have until 2:15, and we have a number of people. We are going to conclude today with the testimony. It's not going to be extended. So we have on the list O.J. Doyle and Bob Johnson to this topic. If they wish to testify, please come down. And then we also have some who I had promised would testify from the morning portion. And those include Liz Carpenter, Buzz Anderson, Matt Flory, and I believe those three are committed to at least making some comments. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association to speak on behalf of the efforts that the Representative Bradley's bill puts forth to somehow or other contain the ever-spiraling cost of various types of insurance from health care providers. I'm not going to read the handout. You can do that at your leisure. Just suffice it to say that the ambulance industry in Minnesota has already been very hard hit as a result of some very poor decisions made by Congress in 2002, which have resulted in a $72 million loss to ambulance revenue in the state of Minnesota. In addition, costs for us have been general liability insurance and vehicle liability insurance. The increases in premiums, if we were able to get insurance at all, were so dramatic from the 2001 to 2003 time period that we sought legislation last year which required the Department of Commerce to investigate the reasons for the increases. Some of the members of this committee were involved in supporting that study,
And I'm very sorry, Representative Bradley had asked if that was available, and it's not finalized yet, but it's very close. I will make sure that that gets to you. What we did is I took an informal poll a year ago trying to get the differences in the general liability premiums, and you can see the numbers here. It was in 2001, 2002. This is a small to medium-sized, full-time, paid, non-government-based ambulance service. Went from $3,500 to $128,000, one renewal period. And our vehicle liability insurance went, in the same period of time, $31,000 to $112,000. And this is without any dramatic changes over a period of 20 years. There have been a number of claims, but it's we need to do something about it. We have a very uneven playing field, and the ambulance industry in Minnesota is a cottage industry. We do not have huge multi-state providers. It's very much people are in contact with their communities, the owners, the managers, are very much involved in with their local elected officials and also various organizations. So for us, we don't have the economies of scale where we can do something about this. And thank you very much for your time and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, OJ. Bob Johnson, if you have anything new to add, I know we heard from you this morning, so if you have something new to add to this discussion.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The only new point I'd add, and there's literature here that I think if the committee doesn't have, I just brought extra copies from the Californians Alive for Patient Protection. This is their literature, and I heard a presentation on it, and I think it speaks to the issue, and maybe that's the only comment I want to make here. It speaks to the issue, do caps, as is contained in House File 1681, do caps impact premiums? I think this is evidence directly to that point. I believe the committee has in their handout or in their folders there the article by the Richard Biondi and Arthur Gurevich about non-economic cap reduced premiums. It's from the contingencies November-December 2003, the National Practitioner Data Bank evidence that supports that conclusion. And lastly, Madam Chair, this is the new evidence. And I don't have copies to leave here today, but I just reference this to the committee. It's I have a draft study, medical malpractice insurance, a study of market conditions done by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the 50-state regulators of the insurance industry. And the executive summary, I'll read you the lead sentence, and I'll follow up with the committee, Madam Chair, and get copies of this. Reasonable limitations, caps on awards for pain and suffering, punitive damages, and other non-economic losses have been shown to have a positive impact on medical malpractice claim costs and rates. So commentary coming from not the insurance industry, but from the regulators of the insurance industry. And included in that executive summary, lastly, specific references to stock market losses. There have been commentary about recoupment, about are we paying for the losses in the stock market. And this is the last sentence I'll share out of that report, Madam Chair, is that the NEIC report on this, looking at best aggregates and averages data, reports that stock investments in medical malpractice insurers only account for 12% of their invested assets. Bonds account for 80% of their investment assets. So the issue of stock market losses, and this is this a dramatic impact? I think the answer is no on that. It's a factor. But with that, Madam Chair, that's the only new additional information. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Huntley.
Just a comment. Mr. Johnson, I always disagree on what's out in the public, but here's General Accounting Office, folks. This is, excuse me, it's the Congressional Budget Office, so this is Washington, D.C. this year, and they based this statement on the General Accounting Office, both of which the General Accounting Office is the executive branch of the federal government. CBO is the legislative branch, both under government control by the Republican administration. Talks about The stock market loss you just brought up, according to the General Accounting Office, annual investment returns for the nation's 15 largest malpractice insurers dropped by an average of 1.6 percentage points from 2000 to 2002, enough to account for a 7.2% increase in premium rates. That figure corresponds to almost half of the 15% increase in rates. So half of the increase in malpractice rates for that year can be attributed to the fact that insurance companies lost a lot of money like everybody else in the stock market.
Well, obviously these statistics and data can be disputed and discussed. And members and those present, we have devoted just about as equal time as I could to both proponents and opponents of this. I want to remind everyone, this is going to be continued in the Civil Law Committee. This is a discussion that will be continued at future times. And so while I mentioned if there are further testimonies that were not able to present today because they were not able to come or they were not interested in talking or speaking, they may submit written testimony, and we will distribute that to all the committee members. And at this point, there are a few folks who were supposed to testify this morning. I want to know if they are here. Matt Flory, if you are, would you come forward from the American Cancer Society? Buzz Anderson, Retailers Association, please come forward, and if Matt is not here, okay, I see Liz Carpenter and Buzz are going to testify together. That's wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. With me today is Liz Carpenter, executive vice president of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this distinguished panel. Because we know there's a shortage of time, Liz and I have decided to try to weave our testimony together, so we'll do as best we can to make it as brief as possible. Like all of you, we understand the important role that pharmacies play as part of the healthcare delivery system. You know, Liz and I both represent many of the same people, pharmacists and pharmacies, who are part of that healthcare delivery system. But we think of pharmacies in two ways. We think of them not only as healthcare providers, but we also think of them as retailers, because in fact they are that. Thankfully, there are people in this society who have made large investments in property, buildings, and inventory to make sure that there are a lot of products or an array of products available to the buying public in this society. However, there are elements in the retail system that make it work really well that seldom are not present in the healthcare delivery system, and I'd like to mention just three of those. When people go into a retail store, number one, they expect they're going to spend their own money. Number two, because they expect they're going to spend their own money, they have an expectation that they'll be shopping, and therefore they have an opportunity to do that by looking at size, quality, reliability, color, quality, durability, and other factors. And lastly, they ultimately make a choice using prices so that they can make a value judgment about their purchases. Again, these elements are not always present in the healthcare delivery system. And I think what Ms. Carpenter is going to try to do today is give you a prime example of how that happened in one particular case in the pharmaceutical situation.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I actually have to make a correction. I am the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, but I appreciate the promotion, Buzz. The purpose of our testimony this morning is to draw attention to an area of potential cost savings that to this point has not really been addressed. The increase in costs associated with prescription benefits continues to be a major concern for the business community and state government. At this point, there have been two components of that benefit to come under scrutiny: the cost of the products and the reimbursement to the pharmacies. The example I'll give to you today was brought to our attention 2 weeks ago by a St. Paul pharmacist and illustrates a third area that needs to be considered. The pharmacist contacted our office and explained that one of his patients came into his pharmacy with a prescription, which they filled. When the pharmacy submitted the claim electronically, the benefit manager transmitted back to the pharmacy the amount of the patient's copay to be $25 and the payment to the pharmacy from the plan to be $5, for a total payment to the pharmacy of $30. Because this pharmacist believes it's important that patients understand the full cost of the drugs, both the patient's copay and the amount paid by their insurance is printed on the receipt. The patient questioned pharmacist regarding the dollar amounts on the receipt, stating that her plan was supposed to be 20-80 coverage, where she would pay 20% and the plan would pay 80, and it appeared to be the other way around. The pharmacist advised the patient to take the question back to her union to investigate the claim. When the union researched the claim, they found that they had been invoiced $100 for the prescription and contacted the pharmacy for verification of the amount they received from the plan. When they received this documentation from the pharmacy that they were paid $5 from the pharmacy benefit manager and $25 from the patient, the union contacted the benefit manager to inquire as to why the patient and the union together were charged $125 when the pharmacy was only paid $30 for the prescription. The union was told that this was an error and that the benefit manager would reimburse it. However, when the pharmacist went back and checked the claims history, and they found that this was not the first time nor the only drug on which this had occurred. The pharmacy was later contacted by the pharmacy benefit manager and told that they could no longer print the amount paid by the insurance on the receipt. The pharmacist went back and researched his contracts, and because there's nothing in there that prohibits him from disclosing this information, he is including it. But I think that what this example speaks to is the lack of information that's available to consumers and purchasers of healthcare benefits of the money, of how the money is flowing, and it's something that should be addressed.
The example that Liz just gave you is just one example, although it is not an isolated example. The reasons why these abuses occur is that there's a lack of information available to patients and employers that if they had, they'd be able to help correct and stop these abuses. These abuses occur because there's a lack of information to pharmacies. These abuses occur because there's a lack of information to employees. These abuses occur because there's a lack of information to employers. These abuses occur because communication of necessary information is prohibited in many cases. Audits by entities familiar with the cost of pharmacy products are necessary. The Minnesota Pharmacy Association and the Minnesota Retailers Association have been attempting to educate self-insured employers and the state on the importance of having their prescription invoices audited by entities that are familiar with the cost of pharmaceuticals pharmaceuticals to identify these situations. For an employer to be billed $95 for the administration of one claim is unnecessary and unacceptable. Public policy to require explanation of benefits is an important first step. By requiring an explanation of benefits to be provided for prescription benefits, including the payment to the pharmacy by the plan, the patient's copay, and the amount billed to the employer, the state would take an important first step in preventing abuses of this kind and helping patients to better understand the full cost of their health care. Thank you for your for the opportunity to speak, and we'd be glad to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you for waiting and being patient. Sorry it had to be so late.
Our pleasure, Madam Chair.
Members, to the bill before us, we are going to bring it back to the committee on Monday the 16th. There may be some modifications that will be made, and so we will make copies available on Thursday the 12th, and that will be in the afternoon, and just watch for an email and that message. Any questions? Representative Bradley, maybe you want
to have comments. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to amplify on that, it is my intention. I've listened very carefully to your testimony and some of the discussion. I would welcome if there's some of the members or other people who have some specific ideas. For example, I think just the one that we heard about disclosure, I've really tried to understand in the pharmaceutical area how we get a better understanding for consumers, and I've never quite figured out how to do it, but if there's an idea how to do it, I would welcome that. It is my intention to have available for members in the public the changes that would be put together by myself, the author, by next Thursday. I also want to acknowledge something. It sort of gets referred to as the Bradley Bill whenever we're talking about the bad stuff. But actually, the bad stuff was put together by Representative Wilkin.
I thought it was eight.
But I do want to acknowledge that there are a number of people on the Republican members of this team and actually beyond this team who worked very hard and should enjoy the pleasure of credit or whatever it may be on the work of this bill. I will say this much, and I think it's been a good, lively discussion. I and my colleagues, and I think all of us on both sides of the aisle, are very serious about trying to do something about one of the most significant, if not the most significant, healthcare problem, and that's the escalating healthcare costs. We may differ from time to time on specific issues, but that doesn't mean that we're not serious. I think this kind of debate has been very helpful as it moves along. I'm very hopeful. I know the media constantly asks me, do I expect something to happen this session? And my reaction is, if we leave this session and we don't make marked work and improvement in trying to control health care costs, I think the public is going to hold all of us accountable, and I think it behooves us to deliver best we can. Thank you.
Thank you, members. The committee is adjourned.